Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party and Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this is Green Socialist Notes, where we talk about education and advocacy and organizing around the eco-socialist program that Angela Walker and I ran on in 2020. So last week, last Sunday, they finally came out with their consensus statement at the COP27 climate conference in Egypt. And not surprisingly, it was disappointing. They did, with the US finally agreeing at the last minute, agree to set up a damage and loss fund to help poor countries that are having damage and loss from climate change compensated, but they didn't put any money in it. They're gonna figure out the details later, which is typical of these conferences. They kick the can down the road. And also later was fossil fuel cuts. We know that the current commitments of countries, which they're not even meeting, is going to push the global climate toward an increase in global temperatures of 3 degrees Celsius, which is, you know, extremely damaging to the climate. But they didn't make any more commitments. So really, it's now up to the social movements around the world to push their nations to make stronger commitments and beyond that, take the actions. And there was an article that I'm going to have the link put in the chat by Simon Pirani, who's a socialist climate researcher, activist, also a solidarity activist with workers and unions in Russia and Ukraine for many years. And he has a good summary. The title is Oil Companies, Dictators, and Greenwashers Captured COP27. And the subtitle is Hope Lies in Movements Outside the Talks. And I think if you read that, you'll get a fuller picture than I'm outlining here. But I think that's the basic picture, that's the basic takeaway we've got to take away and take out to the streets, the communities, and keep building a movement for a global eco-socialist Green New Deal, because that's really the answer to this climate crisis. And then people wanted to talk about the Indian Child Welfare Act, which is up before the Supreme Court. They just had hearings a couple weeks ago. And the Indian Child Welfare Act is a federal law that passed in the late 70s that was designed to keep children who are tribal members with Indian families, Native families. And Congress enacted it after finding out about a decade earlier from a study by the Association of American Indian Affairs that at least 25%, maybe as much as 35% of all Native children had been removed from their families and placed in foster homes, 9 out of 10 times in non-Native homes up to that point, which is really genocide, because you're taking the children away from the tribes and divorcing them from their families and their culture and their nation. And what the Indian Child Welfare Act says is that one part of a child's well-being is preserving the cultural component of their family and the integrity of their tribal nation. It does not explicitly exclude non-natives from fostering or adopting Native children. It's really about the best interest of the children, although the challengers to this law have changed it from being about the political relationship between Indian nations and the federal government into a racial issue. And that's not what the Indian Child Welfare Act was about. And then they use the Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment to challenge this law and say it's unconstitutional. But the political relationship the U.S. government has had with the tribes is based on their status as sovereign nations, not race or blood or anything like that. And if this Indian Child Welfare Act is ruled unconstitutional, all Indian law, which is based on that political relationship between sovereign Indian nations and the federal government, all those laws may be in jeopardy, which puts Indian nations sovereignty and self-rule in jeopardy. And what would happen if the Supreme Court overturns the Indian Child Welfare Act is states would once again be allowed to indiscriminately remove Native children from their families and culture while depriving the tribal nations of their future generations, which would put the nation's existence in jeopardy and reestablish what had been going on over the previous couple hundred years, where, you know, the policy of the U.S. government was to basically wipe out Indians as sovereign political entities. And so the name of the case is called Holland versus Brackeen. And Holland, of course, is the Secretary of the Interior. And it's pending before the Supreme Court. The case was brought by the states of Texas, Louisiana, and Indiana, and some individual plaintiffs. And they're seeking to declare the Indian Child Welfare Act, have it declared unconstitutional. So in 2018, a district court ruled that the law is unconstitutional on the grounds that it violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment and the 10th Amendment states' rights, you know, grounds. So the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals the next year reversed the district court decision, restoring the Indian Child Welfare Act. And then they had it, what they call an en, it's French, I guess, en banc, basically a full panel review of that decision by the whole Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And it basically upheld the previous decision. So now it's on appeal before the U.S. Supreme Court. And the oral arguments were heard on November 9th. And on the opposite side from the states suing to get this law declared unconstitutional are, you know, the Native nations and dozens of child welfare organizations, including the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Medical Association, American Psychological Association, and several state and tribal psychological associations. They have filed amicus briefs defending the Indian Child Welfare Act. It should be noted that the Indian Child Welfare Act is consistent with international law, the 1993 Hague Convention on Inter-Country Adoption, multiple United Nations conventions combating the trafficking of children for adoption, and then the more recent UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. But if the court accepts the argument of the opponents of the Indian nations that this law violates equal protection, as I said, the whole practice of Indian law could be thrown out because it relies on the political relationship between federally recognized tribes and the federal government. So, you know, the court could say that the relationship between indigenous people in this country and the rest of the country is a racial relationship, not a political relationship, which is very problematic because these nations are based on participation in the nation, not who your parents were, grandparents, or great-grandparents were. It's whether you're a member of that community. So at this hearing, it's worth noting that, and this was the November 9th hearing I'm talking about, three-hour hearing, none of the advocates who presented arguments on either side were Native people. In fact, the last time a Native American attorney presented arguments before the Supreme Court on behalf of a Native individual, tribe, or in any case, was 21 years ago. Between 1980 and 2001, 13 indigenous lawyers represented cases for tribes and Native individuals in front of the justices. So we're going backwards in terms of the ability of Native people to advocate for themselves. The Office of Solicitor General, which is the office in the Department of Justice, which argues most cases at the Supreme Court on behalf of the U.S. government, has never had a Native attorney. And since 2001, 37 indigenous individuals or tribal parties have had cases before the Supreme Court, and not any Native attorney has presented oral arguments in any of those cases. So this is a case where it's being decided for Native people above, you know, outside their participation. And it should be noted also that this has wide impact. 11% of U.S. citizens have indigenous ancestry, but of that 11, 8% have no paperwork documenting their tribal membership, leaving only 3% who are enrolled members of federally recognized tribes. But the fact that so many indigenous people are not members of tribes is a consequence of these decades and actually a couple centuries of Native children being taken from tribal nations and, you know, either sent to Indian boarding schools to, you know, assimilate them to the larger culture or to be adopted outside the tribes. And as I noted, that was a quarter to a third of all Indian children until this law passed. So this is an important case. It'll be decided by the end of the current session of the Supreme Court, which ends in June 2023. And it's quite possible, even likely, that this right-wing Supreme Court is going to overturn the Indian Child Welfare Act, which means to protect Native children, we're going to have to codify it in state law. New Mexico has already done that in anticipation, and it's something that we may have to pursue elsewhere. This court is a real problem for human rights, and this is a prime example. So I know that people wanted to have some discussion of that. Maybe we can talk about it more in a question and answer, which I'm looking forward to hearing from you. Amy L. Sachs, I've heard that oil companies are helping to fund the anti-Indian Child Welfare Act campaign because its collapse would make getting their hooks on indigenous land and resources even easier. Haven't seen the receipts though. I did see articles. I didn't have time to read them, but it did say there's big bucks behind this case challenging the Indian Child Welfare Act and through it all Indian law. And so I think you're right, Amy, that the oil companies and the gas companies, the resource companies that want resources off indigenous lands, want to be able to get there without any say-so from the people, the Indian people that live there. And so, you know, that's one of the consequences of this law that I think we have to pay attention to. Mitchell Human, hey, Howie, what do you believe is the best course of action for the federal government to help assist LGBTQ plus children in school systems that discriminate against LGBTQ plus individuals? Well, there's the Equality Act pending before Congress. It's passed the House, hasn't got through the Senate. That would make it illegal to discriminate against LGBTQ plus people, as well as women and anybody based on their gender orientation or expression. And that's, I think, you know, a top priority to get that passed. It's, you know, the House has passed it, the current House wouldn't, but it's an issue that we got to keep before the federal government. And what that does is it sets up legal standards. So then when people are discriminated against, they've got federal law to back up their case, that they have standing against that discrimination in court. And then the other thing I think is, you know, you need affirmation from the top, which we've got to some extent from Biden. We certainly didn't get it from Trump. That LGBTQ plus people are to be valued and respected and their rights to be respected. So I think, you know, changing the culture will help too. And we've made a lot of progress on that. I mean, from the time some Greens in New Paltz, New York, I think it was 2003 or four, started conducting gay marriages, and the Democratic Attorney General got an injunction against that, threatened to throw them in jail if they continued. And they were told they were gonna provoke a backlash. This was when Karl Rove, Bush's brain, was putting anti-LGBTQ plus ballot measures into elections to try to mobilize the right-wing base for Republicans. From that time until, when was it, 11 or 12, when the Supreme Court basically said same marriage equality is constitutional, you know, that was less than a decade. I mean, I've never seen public opinion change so fast on that. People like Obama, you know, were quote unquote evolving. They really had their finger to the wind. And as public opinion changed, politicians like them, like him, and others changed. So the cultural aspect of this is important too, to undermine what the right wing is doing through their overrepresentation and power in the federal government far beyond their numbers. You know, the Supreme Court's not elected. Most of them are now appointed by Republicans, and they're very right wing. They do not reflect the American public, but there they are. So we've got to push on the cultural side of this as well as the legal side, and pushing for the passage of the Equality Act. Via email, thoughts on the recent mass shootings? Oh boy. I think we're in a situation where the people that are sick and want to do these terrible things are, you know, copycatting each other. And I don't know how you deal with that. Again, this is a case where we need both legal remedies and cultural change. The legal remedies are more effective gun safety laws, you know, background checks without loopholes, red flag laws that are enforced, stop selling assault rifles to civilians. Those are weapons of war. You know, people shouldn't have that any more than they should have mortars to shoot around the neighborhood. So there's that side. And then there's the cultural side. I mean, behind these shootings, it's often, you know, racial animus, xenophobia toward immigrants, misogyny, homophobia. So, you know, we've got to combat them and those things, and that's, you know, cultural work. And then, you know, I'm thinking of what I know about what happened at Walmart, where the guy that did the shooting was, seems socially isolated, socially maladroit, and, you know, just festering hatred toward the people he worked with, and decided to take them out. And there may have been some bullying involved or making fun of. So, you know, that's, again, a problem of what goes on in the workplace, where you have these hierarchies where some people are ordering other people around. And, you know, we should have a much more cooperative workplace based on common ownership rather than an ownership class exploiting a working class. That would help change the cultural background where a lot of this violence comes from. You know, they used to call it going postal when an angry postal worker did a mass shooting, I think, back in the 70s. And this is happening with increasing frequency. So, you know, my thoughts are, better gun safety laws and changing the culture so that there aren't people sitting out there nurturing hatred toward other groups of people and then thinking it's incumbent upon them to kill a bunch of those people. That is something that happens more in this country than any other country where there's not an actual war going on. And I think the other thing is the militarism. You know, we got a militaristic culture. The military is often, you know, has a huge PR arm. It goes right into the schools with ROTC programs. The flyovers at football games, you name it, it's everywhere. And, you know, along with that is this sort of Rambo culture. Maybe that's too old a reference for some people listening, but, you know, where you solve problems with a gun rather than, you know, talking it out and coming to a mutually acceptable agreement. So, again, we need a legal side to this, gun safety, and a cultural side, which, you know, undermines these various negative isms that are based on hate. Mitchell Human, to further my question, do you believe that education regarding LGBTQ individuals and identities would help make schools a safer place for LGBTQ plus students and staff? And thank you for all that you do. Absolutely. And I should have, you know, included that in my previous answer. You know, the school should, you know, provide education so that people understand that not everybody is straight and it's all right. And, you know, that it's natural. It's not a lifestyle decision like the right would tell you. It's who these people are. And they have a right to the same rights as everybody else and to respect like everybody else. And that should be part of the school curriculum. And, you know, that's based on the science, not these prejudices that the right wing wants to perpetuate. So, yes, education is part of the answer there through the public school system. Siori Turns Gaming. Victoria election was last night. The Greens won 5 seats. They gained 3. Also had 14% of the vote, up from 10% last election. Votes still not counted. Greens could win another 3. So we're talking about Victoria in Australia or Canada? I'm not up on that. I know we had somebody last week talking about what was going on in Australia, but that's good to know. Australia, okay. And we talked last week about, you know, I've tried to get an Australian Green to talk about what they're doing, because from what I've been reading and hearing, they're doing a good job of grassroots organizing and nation or organization building. They're a membership party, unlike parties in the United States, so that you join a party, you pay dues and support it. You have to agree to the principles. And then you got an organization of members that can agree to undertake activities like the organizing they're doing and be accountable for it. And I think that's what we need here in the United States. And that's why I'd like, you know, to get an Australian Green on here soon to talk about what they're doing and what they can teach us. So, yeah, going from 10% to 14%, I know nationwide the Greens have been at about 10% for a couple elections until the most recent election. They went up to, I think, 12 or 13%. And now it looks like in Victoria, they're up to 14% in the provincial elections. That's good. And we need that because, you know, the Greens in Australia are the party that are really pushing on, particularly the climate question. And that's an issue that concerns all of us. Andrew Hager, to further Mitchell's question on education, how should we go about improving the USA's educational system in general? Well, for one thing, we should stop public subsidies of private education, i.e. charter schools. If people want to set up private schools, fine, but don't rely on the public purse. To call them public schools, which the charter industry likes to do, is like saying Lockheed Martin is a nationalized corporation because it gets most of its contracts from the Pentagon. It's ridiculous. It's privately managed and subsidized with public funding. And what that does is take money from the public schools, which are struggling for funding in many communities, which brings up another thing. We should stop relying on the property tax to fund our schools because property is unevenly distributed, and have a progressive tax. We can do that at the state level with a state income tax. It'd be even better if the federal government did it, because then there's a larger base and you don't have what they call tax jurisdiction competition, where different local or state governments lower taxes to try to attract business. And then they get in a bidding war with each other because businesses sit back and say, well, we're thinking about coming there, but this other state give us a tax break. And so it's a race to the bottom. So funding by progressive income tax instead of property taxes, I think would help a lot with the funding problem. We need to pay the teachers more and value them more. A lot of people are leaving the teaching profession. It's a tough profession, particularly when the schools are underfunded. And the schools are expected to solve a lot of other social problems because we don't have the kind of social services we had, should have, and social supports. People turn to the schools and expect them to make up for deficits in other areas. So, I think particularly in disadvantaged communities, the idea of community schools with wraparound services needs to be supported. Another thing, and I'm trying to remember, I talked about this recently, maybe on this podcast or somewhere else, is we need to value vocational education as well as academic education so that our children and teenagers can not just get caught in one track, one going to college, another going to vocations, but, take courses in both and change their mind about what they want to do. Or just decide to, have an education in both to be well-rounded. In other words, we need to, and this is what the school system, I think, do too much, is they value that academic credentialing so you can get a white-collar job and sit at a desk, and devalue those who do work that has to be done. They get their hands dirty, whether it's plumbing or, electricians or, the grid and getting, lines that fall down fixed or building transmission lines, all those things that are physical or, delivering packages or sorting packages or sorting mail or whatever it is. Though that kind of work needs to be valued and paid more. Otherwise, we're going to have shortages in those areas, and we're going to have people undereducated who are doing the hand labor, and people, doing the so-called brain work, having a good education, but it basically increases inequality. And, and some people, myself included, I went to Ivy League school and I preferred to go work in construction than at a desk. So I was able in high school to both take vocational courses as well as academic courses. I got into a good college, but what I decided to do with that is do physical work because that's what I preferred. And that should not be devalued. At the time, this is the early 70s, wages had been keeping pace with productivity. So working class wages were increasing. And I expected that as I went into work in construction, and that's not what happened. Wages stagnated while productivity kept going up. Another thing I think the education system ought to do. To further Mitchell's question on education, ask Andrew Hager, how should we go about improving? That's the question I was answering. I thought a new one popped up. Amy Sachs. And now teaching is even more physically dangerous. What with cops, quote unquote, protecting schools, but minimal or no COVID protections. Yeah, that's another thing. We've got to, the public health measures have to be defended. And, you know, having cops permanently in schools in almost all cases is not going to lead to reduction in violence. They are trained to deal with physical force to problems. That in many cases, there ought to be more social workers and counselors in the schools to help children and teenagers who are having issues deal with those issues, rather than until they act out and then you got cops coming in and acting, you know, violently against them to suppress whatever's going on. That's not the best solution there. And yeah, I think, you know, some teachers have left the profession because they're not getting the protection from, you know, COVID. They just suddenly Biden declared that the pandemic was over. Not that different than Trump saying it would disappear like a miracle. And what was I reading? I think it was in the Washington Post this morning. Or maybe it was AP or maybe New York Times. But COVID is surging again. And we don't have the masking or the social distancing. The ventilation that needs to be built into a lot of the schools has not been done. And then, you know, the teachers are, you know, out there in that public. And you know how kids are. They don't socially distance. So, you know, infections of various kinds, not just COVID, but the flu and this respiratory illness that, what's it called, RSV, I think, are spreading fast. So, yeah, that's right. It's teaching has got the challenge of just being safe. Frankie Lee, Greens. How do the Greens get nationwide ballot access for 2024? Well, there's no such thing as nationwide ballot access that the federal government does. It has to be done state by state, 51 different jurisdictions. I'm not sure what the current count is for where the Greens have the ballot line in 2024. I think it's around 17 or 18. And if that's the right number, that means we need 32 or 33 petitions in different states to get on the ballot. And that's how we got to do it. So the national party should, but is not capable of mounting a nationwide petition drive where we go through the states. In some states, you can start now, but nobody has. The other thing that traditionally happened is that the presidential candidate does the petition drives. And even before I had the nomination, my campaign was putting a lot of energy into that in 2020. That was true for Jill Stein. It was true for Ralph Nader. Because when you're running for office and you ask for money to get on a ballot, that's people will give money for that. The National Party, unfortunately, doesn't have an effective way of raising money for that purpose or a well-organized plan. I mean, and I did this for Nader and again for Stein. I laid out how, and neither of them followed the plan, but how if we started 2 years before the election, we could start marching through the states. If we had a team of petitioners, that was their job, and we'd raise the money to pay them. They could start now petitioning in some states, and we could go into 2024 after having petitioned in 2023 with, you know, being on a ballot. I forget the number of states, but it was something like 35, 38, something like that. So those states that won't let you petition earlier, like my state of New York, there'd only be about a dozen of them, and it'd be a lot easier. Plus, if we went into 2024 with already all those ballot lines secured, then the media is going to say, well, the Greens are going to be a factor and we got to cover them to some extent. So there are a lot of reasons to do that. And of course, in many states, you get a certain percentage of the vote. It ranges from 0.5% in New Mexico to 20% in Alabama. That's an outlier. Most of them are 1, 2, or 3%. Some are 5%. There may be a 10% in there, I can't remember. But if you get that vote for your presidential candidate, you got a ballot line for the next election cycle or two, which enables our down ballot candidates to run much more easily. It's usually many fewer signatures to get on as the candidate of a party that's recognized than to have to do an independent nominating petition. And that deters a lot of Greens from running because the petition requirement is so much. Whereas if it's just a petition among your party members, like it is in New York, it's 5% of party members in the district you're running. That's not that hard to do. So a lot more people run. So yeah, to get on a ballot across the country in 2024, we got to march through the states, and the state parties, you know, got to get their act together. And, you know, whoever is running a serious national presidential campaign is going to have to start working on that, even if the formal nomination is after some of these deadlines, after some of these deadlines. Most of the deadlines come in the late spring and summer, but you can qualify much earlier. And that's what the Greens have not done, and I'm arguing should do in 2024 or for 2024. Via email, thoughts on the Biden administration removing some sanctions against Venezuela and continuing talks. I'm not familiar with the exact sanctions they lifted, but I don't think the sanctions against Venezuela were effective in, you know, making the changes that the U.S. professed it wanted, which was more democracy and recognition of human rights. The U.S. has a lot of gall even saying that when they picked this guy Juan Guaido to replace Maduro without an election, you know, talk about violating human rights. So I'm glad to see they're talking. Obviously, the U.S. wants Venezuela to start exporting more oil in the current situation with the sanctions against Russia. But I think, you know, we're better off normalizing relations with Venezuela, helping. I mean, that country's really in trouble in terms of its economic problems and what you know, the problems poor people are facing. I mean, they've had millions of people leave the country, you know, just because of the dire economic situation. So we should help them with that. And I think, you know, if you're interested in more liberalization of the politics, you're going to make more progress doing that than blockading or sanctioning, because that gives the government an excuse to say, you know, we're under attack from the U.S., so we got to crack down on dissent at home. The classic case of that is Cuba. What is it now? 1960 to 2020 would be 62 years now of blockading Cuba. And it hasn't, you know, liberalized their political system. So maybe we should try a new tack. And we started moving a little bit that way in the Biden administration. Trump closed that down. I'm sorry, the Obama administration. Trump closed that down and Biden hasn't reopened. You know, I'm talking about Cuba now. And I think that's, you know, Cuba is another place where the people are really suffering, and the blockade is part of the reason. You know, those sanctions punish ordinary people, and we shouldn't be doing that. Andrew Hager. Also, what all should we do to put an end to homelessness for domesticated animals and possibly push for improving health care for our pets? Well, we need, that's a, you know, like many social or public services, that is underfunded. You know, what we need is, you know, what do you call it? You take care of the dogs and the cats so they aren't producing children that aren't wanted. What do you call that? I forget what you call it, but so that's one thing. So there are less pets that are homeless. You know, we rely on private agencies like the SPCA, that some of them get public funding. There should be sufficient public funding so that, you know, all these domesticated animals that are homeless are taken care of and don't have to be put down because there are just too many to take care of. And improving health care for pets, I think that's something we should discuss as part of a national healthcare system, because pets are really part of families. And they provide, you know, documented benefits to people in terms of their well-being and their health. So, you know, taking care of the health of the pets is part of taking care of the health of families. And I'm thinking out loud now, but that just makes obvious sense to me. I've never seen discussion of, you know, how a public healthcare system could take care of, you know, domesticated animals who are pets. But, you know, maybe we talked about it here first. It's something that seems to make sense to me. Via email, thoughts on the collapse of FTX and the larger crypto sector. Yeah, well, that always struck me, and I never looked at it closely, as a Ponzi scheme, because the value was based on, you know, how many people wanted these, you know, imaginary value, you know, these documentation of value, I guess is the way you put it. There was no underlying assets backing them up. So if the value went down, you know, you lose out. And so I think it required some regulation. And I do know that, you know, little investors are getting hurt. I've seen some stories on that in the media. And I don't know what recourse they have. There's not like the equivalent of a FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, for investors in crypto. No, there, nor should there probably be. I mean, I guess the best these consumers that are getting fleeced can say is they were falsely advertised to, but I don't know how good a case that would be. So, you know, we just had in New York a law passed that put a temporary referendum on moratorium on proof of work crypto mining, where crypto companies were taking over abandoned fossil fuel power plants and using the energy they could produce to do this crypto mining to set up this energy intensive form of cryptocurrency. It's only 2 years. It grandfathers in the existing plants. It's not the greatest law. And it took the governor, it passed in June. It took her until after the election to sign it. And after the collapse of a lot of these cryptocurrencies, we know she got a lot of money for her campaign from the crypto mining industry, the crypto industry. So we got a little regulation in New York, but yeah, those are my thoughts. I've kind of watched, you know, Bitcoin and all that other stuff, just kind of shaking my head without looking in the details, because it just seemed to me like a, you know, a pyramid scheme, and there was no base to that pyramid, and now it's collapsing. So I do know there's been talk of some regulations so that people don't get fleeced by things like this, and that's probably a good idea. But I'm not an expert on it. Via email, thoughts on the protests in Brazil and their potential to threaten the outcome of the election in a transition to power. Yeah, the right wing has been protesting, and Bolsonaro said he wasn't going to contest the election, or he's going to cooperate with the transition, but is contesting the election as being rigged. I think that's where he's at. And so the right wing is out on the streets making things difficult for Lula as he comes into power. I think, you know, the people that support Lula have to also be mobilized to support the government and see through the completion of power, transition of power. And, you know, we should keep an eye on that and make sure the U.S. isn't meddling. I think the U.S. was not happy with Bolsonaro. He's kind of crazy like Trump, unpredictable, extreme right wing to the point of irrational, even from the viewpoint of imperialistic capitalists that want to make money in Brazil. Lula, on the other hand, is more of a defender of working people and oppressed groups, which mean it's harder to exploit people in Brazil. So I guess, you know, U.S. Ruling class may be ambivalent about Lula, but my impression is they think they can do business with him, whereas Bolsonaro is a wild card. But anyway, we should keep an eye on that and make sure oppose if the U.S. is doing anything to abet to help Bolsonaro in his objection to the election. He lost it, and he should accept it and tell his people to accept it. Frankie Lee, Howie, and they say Lula isn't in good health. I had not heard that. But he should take care of himself because people in Brazil brought him back. And, you know, I'm thinking about U.S. intervention. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that the court cases that were brought against Lula and his successor, who was also from the same Workers' Party, were trumped up with the help of U.S. Department of Justice lawyers, I believe. And that is, you know, unconscionable intervention. And, you know, in the end, I think Lula got a clean slate from the judicial system down there after things like this were revealed. Maybe the U.S. intervene and you know, what they say, be careful what you wish for. They got somebody to replace Lula, who is, you know, a nutcase, Bolsonaro. But I hadn't heard Lula's health was not good. That's, I'm sorry to hear that. Violet at Content Boutique. Chris, I just want to talk about the local stuff. Green New Deal, social justice, that the Green Party promotes, green policy in general. Whenever Howie's ready to chat about those things. Okay, Violet's addressing Chris, who's behind the screen, who fields the questions. And I'm down with that. I'm ready to talk about local stuff, what we can do, the Green New Deal. Frankie Lee, Howie, how's your running mate for governor? What's she doing now? That would be Gloria Matera. She's doing fine. I think recovering a little bit from our election campaign. And, you know, what we're doing in New York next is, you know, we're going to have a meeting to talk about what's next for the state party. And Gloria's involved in organizing that. So, yeah, Gloria's doing fine. The email, thoughts on the protests in Brazil and their potential? We already answered that question. Let's see. Here we go. Via email, thoughts on nuclear waste storage being expanded. What's going on now with nuclear waste is it's being stored at the plants. And it has to be expanded at those plants if they're still operating, because you got more spent nuclear fuel rods and other forms of radioactive waste. I haven't heard anything about a national repository for that waste advancing. That's been talked about for a long time, but there's problems with that, including transporting it. We used to call it mobile Chernobyl. So, you know, maybe the best solution is to keep it at the sites where these, you know, nuclear plants were built and set up good monitoring and protection, you know, from terrorists seizing the the highly radioactive materials for, you know, for their nefarious designs. What concerns me is there's a lot of talk now about a new generation of nukes, which when you look at it are really, they're basically bringing back old ideas that failed the first time around, you know, like thorium or, you know, smaller modular nuclear power, which is less cost efficient in terms of you don't get the economies of scale. But there's a lot of money behind that. It's part of the what's called the Inflation Reduction Act that I call Build Back Badly. There's subsidies for new nuclear power there. It's something that is being promoted as an alternative to fossil fuels. But with the amount of money you would spend, you know, building new nuclear power plants, you could build a lot more generation capacity in wind and solar with that same money and get it up a lot quicker. So, you know, nuclear is just a dumb idea. Now, they also say that you need it to provide base load so that, you know, the intermittent nature of wind and solar means sometimes they won't be generating power. But there are all kinds of ways of storing power now. Batteries are getting more cost effective. You can do it physically, pump water up, and then let it run down into a generator and generate electricity that way. Geothermal, deep geothermal is advancing. So you can drill down and use the heat in the earth to create steam, you know, and that operates 24/7. So there are ways to provide base load. Plus, you know, the balancing of wind and solar, the solar obviously, you know, generates more in the day. The wind tends to generate more at night. So that kind of balances out. So you already have some stability. And what we need to also do is extend or strengthen the long distance transmission lines, high power, high voltage lines, so that, you know, as the sun goes across the United States, you can generate, you can send the power where it's generated to where it's needed. And a lot of the wind and solar potential is in the Southwest and the plains, and a lot of need is on the coasts and the, you know, the Great Lakes Belt and the East Coast. So you need those high voltage transmission lines to get the power to where it's needed from where it's generated. All those things make a lot more sense to spend money on than nuclear power, which still, you know, presents the problem of catastrophic accidents, long-term storage. They've never made money, you know, over the life cycle of nuclear power plants. And then when they're used up, you got to watch them for hundreds of thousands of years, at least the waste. So to decommission them is a huge expense that is sometimes left out of the equation because people are looking at just what it costs to generate, you know, a kilowatt when the plant is operating at present. And that takes out the cost of building it and the cost of decommissioning it. So there's just a lot of reasons to stay away from nuclear power. Violated content will tweak. Howie, what should we do as individuals to prepare for the climate transition? Go off the grid over here on the West Coast? No, I think you want to stay hooked up to the grid. If you have solar panels and you're generating more power from those panels than you need in your home, you want to sell it to the grid and make some money. And then when it's nighttime and your solar panels aren't generating electricity, you want the grid to, you know, provide power to your house. You know, same with wind. So it's not going off the grid. It's building a resilient grid that's based on these decentralized sources of power because the wind blows and the sun shines everywhere. And instead of centralized power plants, and building a grid that is smart, that can, you know, take the power from where it's generated and put it where it's needed. So now as individuals, you know, it's nice if you can afford to, you know, build the solar panels, a small wind generator, have storage, you know, batteries or whatever. But the problem is the capital costs are high. Once you build that stuff, You know, the sun shines, the wind blows, that you don't have to pay for fuel. It's there. The energy's there. It's how do we pay for the upfront costs? And we can't do that or shouldn't rely on individuals to do that. We should have, that should be socially funded so that a social fund, a public bank or your utility that's publicly owned or some institution like that provides the upfront capital financing to retrofit, you know, your building or your business. And that includes energy efficiency measures as well as solar and wind applications. And then that's paid up front by the public fund. And then you pay off the difference over time. And your costs, your bills are going to go down because you're not buying a fossil fuel, you know, gas or heating oil or whatever to power or and heat your building. So we as individuals need to work collectively to make the climate transition, I guess is what I'm saying, and come up with the institutions that will finance the transition that's as is applied to our own living and working places. Mitchell Human, thoughts on the current situation regarding the missile explosion in Poland and how it relates to the war? This has got all out of proportion, you know, with people speculating whether it was a Russian missile that went off course or a Ukrainian air defense missile that tried to knock down a Russian missile that went off course. In either case, it didn't hit Poland on purpose. That's the most important thing. How it relates to the war, it shows that what's going on in Ukraine can't spill over. I think while it's tragic, those two farmers lost their lives in Poland, half of Moldova is without power because of strikes by the Russians on Ukrainian energy infrastructure. And Moldova depends a lot on Ukrainian power sources. And that I think is, you know, the biggest problem with missiles right now. Ukraine doesn't have enough air defense to stop all the missiles and drones. So it's degrading their energy system to the point where winter will become a weapon of mass destruction. You know, it gets below zero in Ukraine during the winter. And if the people don't have heat, they're going to freeze to death. They don't have running water. That's a problem. And of course, the children, you know, over, what is it, 2,300 schools have been hit by the Russians in their, you know, missile strikes and mortar and everything. And so a lot of the kids weren't going to schools. They didn't have bomb shelters there. They were taking their lessons online. And now the internet is out much of the time. So they're taking the education away from the children of Ukraine. You know, that's the big problem with missiles. And, you know, that's why I still think the demand should be, you know, Russian troops out and Russia back off. There's a lot of talk about how the U.S. somehow made Putin do this, and he's destroying Ukraine in self-defense. That's absurd. That's ridiculous. There are massive war crimes going on in Ukraine. You know, they're grabbing children. We were just talking about that in the case of indigenous people here. They're grabbing thousands of children. The Russians claim more than even the Ukrainians have documented, and shipping them off to be adopted by Russian families and brought up as Russians. That is a crime of genocide. This bombing of civilian infrastructure is a war crime, a crime against humanity. And then you've got the filtration camps, basically concentration camps, where they so-called filtrate all the people under Russian occupation to see if they're pro-Russian or pro-Ukrainian, take their personal and biometric data so they can surveil them. And those people that are perceived as pro-Ukrainian often end up in prison, you know, often without sufficient food and water, sometimes torture, sexual assault, and death. And that's what's going on. These are war crimes. And for people to say the U.S. should not provide arms to Russia, to Ukraine, you know, like air defense systems so they can shoot down these missiles that are destroying their country, to me is being pro-war. There's a difference between an oppressive or oppressor nation aggressing against another nation that it wants to recolonize. And the colonized, oppressed nation fighting back in self-defense. If you can't see the difference between those two things, you can't see the difference between a rapist and the rapist victim. They have the right to self-defense, and we should support that right. I mean, if we're socialists or Greens, we're about uplifting the oppressed and defending people who are assaulted. So I think those questions are a lot bigger than this missile that ended up, hitting that village and killing those two farmers in Poland. That's pretty clear it was an accident. I know there's a lot of speculation. You know, Zelensky was maintaining for a while that he was sure it was a Russian missile, when NATO and the U.S. was saying no, it's a anti-aircraft or anti-missile from Ukraine. And everybody is getting all worked up, and there are conspiracy theories going around, like that location of that village in Poland was the same, longitude of Lviv and latitude of Kyiv. And people were saying, well, the Russian missile people must have put in, mixed up their targets, and they got the longitude from Lviv and the latitude from Kyiv when they're aiming at something else, or Lviv or Kyiv. And, I don't see what use there is in speculating on that. It's clear it was an accident, and thank God, so that, it didn't bring NATO into the war directly, because that's what an attack on Poland, a NATO member, would have meant. And then we'd be in an even worse situation than we are now. Frankie Lee, the real new threat to the possibility of peace is Germany putting its missiles in Poland. I don't know. I don't agree with that. They're there as missiles. They're anti-aircraft missiles. They're defensive missiles. They're not offensive missiles. And they're doing that because Poland is afraid that Russia's going to be back. Russia, or before that, the Soviet Union. And there were periods in history where it was the Tsarist Russian Empire, ruled Poland. And so, Poland is worried about that. The threat to peace is the fact that Russia is assaulting Ukraine. It's a war of aggression. That's the supreme war crime, according to the Nuremberg Tribunal after World War II. That's what broke the peace. And, these people saying that we can't send arms to Ukraine to defend itself is escalating the war. I mean, the escalation, Putin just drafted 3,000 people to be cannon fodder for his invasion of Ukraine. Since early October, they've been sending their missiles against civilian power, heat, and water infrastructure. That's an escalation. And in fact, Ukraine is not getting what it's asking for. They wanted the MiG-29s, the old Soviet MiG-29s. Poland was willing to give them those if the U.S. would replenish Poland's fighter jets with more modern U.S.-built fighter jets. And the U.S. said no. They limit the range of the artillery that the U.S. provides, the missiles that the U.S. provides for the HIMARS, which is an acronym for a missile system. Modern tanks. Ukraine is using the old Soviet tanks. They'd like to get the NATO standard Abrams tanks. U.S. won't provide that. They want, for missile defense, they'd like the Patriot system. The U.S. has said no, and that would take a long time to install anyway. So, from Ukraine's point of view, the U.S. is being stingy in terms of the weapons they need to defend themselves. The air defense is pretty sophisticated these days if you have enough and the right kinds, and Ukraine doesn't. It's actually knocking down a majority of the missiles and those low-cost drones that Iran has supplied to Russia. But I mean, the drones, the missile systems don't, any air defense missile systems don't work so good against the drones because they fly low and slow. It's just a different threat. So you may have seen how police in cities like Kyiv are firing, you know, assault rifles into the air to try to stop these drones, as opposed to a real air defense system. So I think the threat to peace is Russia's aggression. I mean, that's the bottom line. That's what started this whole mess. Richard Pink, to what extent should the war situation be negotiated in order to deter World War II, I think you mean III, or a possible nuclear war? What kind of compromise seems reasonable to you? Well, it's really up to the Ukrainians what they're willing to compromise. Zelensky and the Russian negotiators seem to have come to an agreement at the end of March, which provided for Ukraine being neutral, not being part of NATO or another military alliance, remaining non-nuclear, continuing, and this was in their constitution as the no nukes part was, to not have foreign troops based in Ukraine. And in return for that, they wanted a treaty that would guarantee their security, signed by Russia, China, the US, UK, France, Germany, big powers. So that would be stronger than the 1994 Budapest Agreement, which wasn't a treaty, but, you know, a signed agreement where the Russians took the Ukrainian nuclear missiles and materials in return for, you know, saying that they would respect Ukrainians' integrity, territorial integrity. Of course, that's been violated. So that's why they want a treaty. And then the other part of the agreement was, we'll go back to the February 24th, 2022 boundaries, where the Russians occupied Crimea and parts of Luhansk and Donetsk. And we'll resolve those areas diplomatically over a number of years, you know, and that probably would mean finding a way to have referendums on status that were open to everybody eligible to vote and internationally observed. And so that's what the compromise, which is similar to the Minsk agreements, Zelensky was willing to do, and the Russian negotiators seemed willing to do. But then Putin and Lavrov said no. And of course, this is when Russia was still advancing, or it was actually at their peak of their advancement, because they started losing ground. They've been losing ground ever since March 21st. But, you know, this was at the end of March when Zelensky, you know, put out the latest proposal that they've been talking about, and the Russian leadership rejected it. And then after that, the Russians were pushed out of the Kyiv region, and they found what happened in Bucha and Irpin and these other suburbs of Kyiv. You know, the massacres, the torture, the killings. And that really pissed off the Ukrainian people. And at that point, they were saying, no, we don't want to negotiate about the occupied territories. We just want to push Russia out. And that's where the people of Ukraine are now. The latest poll on that question was in early September by the Kyiv, it's called, the acronym is KIIS, K-I-I-S. It's a sociological institute. And Gallup had a similar poll, and Sociological Institute found that 87% of Ukrainians did not want to compromise land for peace. In other words, give the Russians some land in order to have a peace agreement. Only 8% of Ukrainians supported that. The Gallup poll at the time showed, I think, 84% support for Zelensky and 94% support for the Ukrainian military. And that was before the military had their big advances in Kharkiv and the northeast and Kherson in the south. So that's where the people of Ukraine are at. So while I think the Minsk-like agreement that Russia and Ukrainian negotiators seem to have agreed on at the end of March, I think it was reasonable. That's my opinion. But the Ukrainians, it's their country and it's their opinion that counts. And right now, they're in no mood to compromise with Russia after all they've done, all that Russia has done to Ukraine. Now, we got to recognize negotiations are going on. The U.S. and Russia are still talking about the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty. Those talks have continued. The Iran nuclear deal, although with all the turmoil in Iran now, it's been on hold. But, you know, the U.S. and Russia were participating in those talks together. They got the grain deal. They've had troop exchanges, although that's more between Ukraine and Russia. So there are negotiations going on. We've had news in recent weeks about high-level meetings between the CIA and head and his counterpart in Russia, and then the who was it from the State Department? Well, anyway, it's State. It wasn't Blinken. It was the other guy and his counterpart from Russia. So there are talks going on, and undoubtedly those are negotiations. But the bottom line is what the Ukrainians are willing to accept, and at this point, their position is, you know, Russian troops out of the whole country. And Putin's position, which he articulated when he gave a speech upon annexing four provinces, which he didn't completely control even at that time, and he controls less now. He said, we're willing to talk, but not about the Russian occupied territories. Those are non-negotiable. So the two sides, Ukraine and Russia, are far apart. And now I think some people want to cut off U.S. NATO arms to Ukraine to provide leverage to get them to accept the compromise they just have to accept because they don't have the arms to defend themselves. And, you know, while publicly the U.S. and the NATO countries aren't saying that, I wouldn't be surprised if privately they're thinking that's what we want to do and sell the Ukrainians out. Because from the viewpoint of Western imperialists, you know, they want stability so they can do business. Most of them, you know, the Russian market's bigger than the Ukrainian market. They just assume the sanctions come down, they go back and do business in Russia. Now, there are business interests that benefit from the war. Obviously, the arms manufacturers and probably the oil and gas industry who are taking market away from Russia to provide to Europe. So, you know, in terms of what different business interests want among, you know, in U.S. imperialism, there's probably differences. But if you, you know, listen to the Ukrainians and particularly the Ukrainian left, which has a better analysis of Western imperialism in Ukraine than anybody, they are worried that at some point the U.S. and the rest of the West is going to decide we want to enter this, and the Ukrainians are just going to have their country dismembered, because we're not going to provide them anymore with arms. Or what's equally important is the humanitarian aid. I mean, Ukraine is broke. Their economy is destroyed by the war. And if the West doesn't provide them funds, their soldiers won't be paid, their teachers won't be paid, their utility workers won't be paid, they won't be able to pay anybody. So the West has a lot of leverage over Ukraine, that's true. But the right thing to do is let the Ukrainians dictate the terms for their own country. So yeah, that's what I can tell you about negotiations. It's complicated, but you know, the bottom line is the Ukrainians, it's their country and they should be in the driver's seat. So wow, we've gone 15 minutes over the normal time, and I appreciate the questions and the discussion. Next week, as far as I know, last time I talked to her, we're gonna have back God, I'm blanking on people's names. The doctor from Pittsburgh, Claire Cohen, who we talked about, you know, National Health Service as opposed to just having Medicare for all last time. And there were a lot of questions that didn't get answered in that session. So we're going to go back to answering them next week and talking about as I think it was Amy or Frankie wanted to, you know, get back to some local issues. Well, we're going to talk about healthcare. That's next Saturday, December 3rd. So have a good week. I hope your holiday has been relaxing and you had a good time with family and friends. And we'll see you next week. We got power, love.